Welcome to this evening teaching and meditation. And first thing, I would like you to know who is giving the teaching. It's this one. And I dared to bring it into the meditation hall. I have been told about the good old custom not to represent the ultimate. And this was also a custom in the Buddhist tradition. I don't know if you have been to India and if you could visit the caves of Ajanta. These are the oldest stone carvings of the Buddhist tradition. And there's no Buddha there. The seat, the throne, is empty because in the early centuries, there was no representation of the Buddha. You know who did this? These were the Greek artists, the Greeks, when they came across the Hindu Kush, you know, Alexander the Great, elephants, 333, and so on, you know, the whole story. Then he came over and he entered the place which was called the Kingdom of Gandhara. Yeah, this Gandhara kingdom actually lasted for 700 years in this area, which is nowadays Pakistan, going up to Kashmir, Ladakh, that region, you know. And he went until there and he was a little bit tired, but he left his artists and he exchanged elephants for peace, and he left someone there and retreated. And these artists, they said, "What? You don't have a representation of your god, you know, the Buddha?" They thought it was a god, and they tried out all kinds of representations of the Buddha. Riding on a horse because he was a prince, or with a kind of armor because he was strong. But finally, fortunately, the peaceful version succeeded. Yeah, this was the success. And of course, he was shaved. I mean, he didn't have this little, you know, blue hair all curled up on his head. He was never like that. He was probably quite emaciated. But emaciated was not good because it thin, yes, like he was really thin and only eating one meal a day. And, you know, he had been very thin, bony, really, when he attained enlightenment. But since he is radiating peace and serenity and prosperity and all of that, then the Greek made him a very well-proportioned, everlasting young man, in spite of all his teachings on change and impermanence. You know, he was made the eternal youth, and he is my teacher. I never met him, but from my early childhood, I was very inspired every time the word came on him, and I considered myself a Buddhist at the age of 18 without ever having met a Buddhist teacher. So I was really like very inspired by that and started meditating at that time. And later on, I met, this was in 1981, yes, I was 22 years old in my medical studies, and Geno Rinpoche, this Tibetan teacher, came to Freiburg in Germany, southern Germany, where I was studying. And my girlfriend, she said, "There's this Tibetan master coming, you should come." And I said, "No, I practice Vipassana. You know, that's enough for me." And, you know, and actually, I was very much silent. "No, no, no, you have to come." And this good old guy, he was talking the whole weekend on bodhicitta. I will also fill your ears with bodhicitta teaching, yeah, on the enlightened mind, bodhi, awakening, citta, mind, mind of awakening. And it touched my heart. And you know, I was like, so much, this one weekend, I mean, we're just having a weekend for some of you, so I won't be able to do what he has done to me. But it was very inspiring. And later on, I became a student. So for the last 11 years of his life, I lived with him. I stayed in retreat 7 years. He made me one of his successors, and I guided the retreats after him. This 3-year, 3-month retreat, you know, maybe you have heard about that. It's one of those customs in the Tibetan tradition, especially Kagyu and Nyingma tradition, we do these long retreats, and that has become my life. You know, I didn't become a doctor finally because of him. He said, you know, like after I'd finished my 7 years of retreat and I was made a retreat teacher, and I said, but I have debts with the government in Germany. You know, they financed part of my studies. And he said, how much? And I said, the sum. And if I go to work as a doctor half a year, I can easily pay that back. And he said, you can take it from the dana, from the donations. You don't waste your time being a doctor. You know, you teach Dharma. And within a year, you know, by the blessing of Buddha Dharma Sangha, of, you know, I could pay back everything without ever going back into hospital. And this was kind of his example. You live from dana, and dharma is only dana, like you live it here. And Tovana is really same place. It's like this, the dharma is for free. You have to pay for your lodging and food, that's clear, but dharma is always for free. And when our money was running out, you know, we had built this retreat center and our resources were out, he said, well, no more money, build a stupa. You know, spend the rest of your money on building a stupa and you will see. And it worked, you know, and this is like how I got involved with this very inspiring person, Gyanen Rinpoche. I got involved with actually developing a very large monastery, Mahamudra tradition, in France, learning Tibetan with him, becoming a translator from Tibetan into mostly German, but also English, French. And this, if you want to understand me, you have to understand this guy. Unfortunately, when I put together this book in German, we also translated it into English. So you can have a look. I will pass it through. You just pass it on to everybody. Just as I'm talking, just let it move through. So you have a little idea, because to talk about me is not much of an issue if you don't know these two. Yes, and Gautama Buddha, we call him Shakyamuni Buddha in our tradition, the mighty one of the Shakyas, which was the clan, the family he belonged to. And then he inspired me so profoundly that still today, I study his teachings, his sutras, and it has been my joy, and also supported by my teacher Gyanen Rinpoche, to combine the tradition coming from the Pali texts, the Pali suttas, with the Sanskrit sutras and the tantras, which are also in Sanskrit. I'm a tantric Buddhist teacher, so to combine these different strands of teaching. And it is in this spirit that I come here, in this one Dharma spirit. It's one teaching. And basically, we will never be doing anything else but to practice the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Paths. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. Mahamudra is not something else than that. It is just an elaboration on the theme. It is giving a little bit different accents to the teaching. And it's my pleasure to share that with you. And he encouraged me very much, all of what I had learned in the Vipassana tradition. I was in the tradition of Saya Ubakin, you know, this Mother Sayama. She was a co-student with Goenka, with Ubakin, and she taught in England. So every 3 months I went over to do a 10-day retreat, because I just felt I needed another injection, you know, to, so to speak, a booster for my spiritual motivation to keep up my daily practice. So every 3-4 months I had to go. So I went and sat with her, and I sat many retreats. I sat with Anagarika Muninja in Bodh Gaya, that was a famous teacher at that time in India. And it was in those days also, together with my then wife, she's a Buddhist nun today. I also was a Buddhist monk for 21 years, but she is still a nun today. And it was in those days that we sat together with Stephen Batchelor, Fred von Eymann, studying Abhidharma together. And, you know, these oldies, which are, you know, from the Vipassana tradition nowadays, at that time, some of them, they were studying with Geshe Rupten and the Tibetan Gelugpa tradition. And we were moving everywhere we could receive Dharma, you know. I did my Mahamudra preliminaries, which are usually 111,000 prostrations, but we definitely did them in kilometers. Yes, moving from one teacher to the next, doing our kilometers in going to the Netherlands, seeing someone in Italy, going to France, coming back to Germany, you know, wherever they were, we followed, because it was very rare in those times. Very rare to meet them, very precious. And this affluence of teachers that we have now was not there. And not to speak of books, you know, we all read the same books, you know, you could know them all in those days, the Buddhist books. There was no, you know, so we basically got the same training. Jnanaponika, for example, yes, was, or Philip Kaplow, the Three Pillars of Zen, you know, and so on. These were, and we read and we studied the sutras, you know, the suttas, if you want. No one understood them really, but they were very inspiring, and we asked our teachers, what do they mean? They tried their best to explain to us, and like this we grew up. Yes, like this we matured a little bit. We saw the need for practice, and so instead of settling down as a homeopathic doctor after my studies, I was offered a place in Switzerland. Together with my wife, we decided to say, okay, we get the foot into the door before settling down as a doctor, because then I can't be free anymore. We take 4 years, 4 years for practice, intensive practice in full retreat. I built a blockhouse in France next to my teacher, Gyanon Rinpoche, who lived in Dordogne in France, southern France at that time. And we went into retreat, and we thought, we are doing the great thing. And when we asked Gyanon Rinpoche, can we come for retreat? You know, we have 4 years. And he said, yeah, you're very welcome, you can come. But be prepared that it might take a little longer. This was the first interview with him about retreat. You know, because he came out of 30 years of retreat. Yeah, he had done them in caves in the Himalayas. He had done one retreat of 7 years in one cave of Padmasambhava, Guru Rinpoche. You know, this guy was actually meditating with just a cotton shawl in the snows. You know, this good old Tummo practitioner who didn't need to heat up externally. So it's this kind of transmission which I received then, and which I'm passing on. Also, there's lots and lots to that transmission, like thousands of hours we were sitting with him and receiving explanations. And I'm not exaggerating. It's really thousands of hours, yes. So many, many years and many encounters. And if we are going to condense that into a weekend, well, we are not going to try. No, we are not condensing something else. I will try to hear what you are saying, look into your eyes, try to feel what you might need, and choose from that very rich background that which is most helpful to you. Continue for the rest of the week for those who wish to stay. And just pass on, as you can maybe hear from how I talk about it, pass on some of the inspiration. That's maybe the most important thing. Now, when I'm asked, what is Mahamudra, which is maybe also a question in the room now, huh? Because I've been asked by Stephen and Lila to kind of introduce the Mahamudra here in, is that right? Yes, so here in Eindhoven, in Tovana. And Mahamudra is a way to realize the nature of mind through blessing, that means through inspiration. It is using the path of inspiration. you know, an opening of the heart which goes beyond all that self-protection, all that so-called ego clinging. We will talk about that, what is meant by that. But to leave that beyond by an inspiration where we forget ourselves. So it's called the path of blessing. Mahamudra is not for the studied ones. I have studied a lot. Fortunately, from the point of view of being able to explain, it's always good to study if you want to explain the Dharma. But maybe unfortunately, because I've spent so many hours in studying language, studying text, translating, and so on, that I should have meditated. You know, I should have maybe used the time to practice a little bit more. So I will share that with you as much as I can, the various sources of inspiration and that which has been of good guidance to me and to my students, to my fellow practitioners, and of course, to all those centuries of practitioners. And you know that the Tibetan tradition has been proven by disaster. Yes, it has gone through difficulties that you know of. You know, they were all exiled. These teachers only came to us because of living through heavy situations, and they all lost many people. You know, 2 million Tibetans were killed of the 5 million which were there. You know, it's a big number. And I know what the Jewish people have gone through. I know what led to the founding of Israel. I'm very aware of that. And I'm kind of bringing you the Dharma that has worked for the Tibetans to be so happy, so loving, in spite of all of that. And maybe, as some would say, because of it. Gachen Rinpoche, one of the famous teachers of the Drikung Kagyu lineage, who spent 20 years imprisoned, you know, coming out from there, he talks very touchingly about how he used every difficulty to strengthen his practice. And he did. And I will share that with you. Of course, I've also had my challenges, but probably not like you. But I will share some of that as it comes along. The main teaching will be on meditation. But there is more to the Mahamudra tradition than meditation. Huh? It is not just that. In the little text I wrote for you when announcing this course, I gave a summary of the Mahamudra tradition. Maybe you remember? I will take it as a starter now, okay? The Mahamudra, if you want to explain later when you come home and someone asks you, what is Mahamudra? Yeah, please remember three words, view, meditation, action. View, meditation, action. We have to do with an action-oriented form of practice. It's all about activity. And that's maybe a new thing for you when, you know, I don't know how, for example, Lila teaches or Mikhail, but the classical Vipassana approach is not so much about activity. It is maybe more about individual liberation and spending a lot of time in retreats and silence and so on. The Mahamudra approach is one for very much designed for so-called householders, for people living at home, working, having children, maybe having a farm in those days, and going the path of the bodhisattvas. And that means some bodhisattva means sattva is a being, someone, and bodhi, walking the path of bodhi, of awakening, but means first walking a path of uniting compassion and wisdom in a very active way. Like I guess most of you are doing. I see, look into your eyes and I can see many, many who have that aspiration to actually find ways of uniting that. And it was meant for people who, like the Buddha, wanted to spend the rest of their life after finding awakening to share it with others. Maybe you know the life story of the Buddha well enough to know that he was enlightened at the age of 35. That's quite young. And he was so fortunate to live until he was 80. So for 45 years, he walked a country like yours, barefooted, and up and down northern India and all across, and answered two questions. That was basically his job. He was only answering two questions all the time. And that became his teaching. And he served the people. He served the rich, the outcasts, the poor, the prostitutes, the farmers, whoever came along. He made no difference. Everyone was welcome. And that's the basic message we are continuing today. And it is this activity of the Buddha after his nirvana, after having found that deep peace of mind. It is one possible translation for nirvana. Yes? This deep peace of mind, when he had found that, he felt encouraged to share it. And it was difficult. He did not know the words. He was struggling to find the words to share it. And we, 2,500 years later, we have a very strong tradition of words now. We can rely on the words of our teachers and of all these generations who have passed on the words. And nowadays we have them in many languages, many, many, many languages. I just spent the last night with my Greek translator. She has translated a major Mahamudra manual into Greek, The Ocean of True Meaning by the Ninth Karmapa, one of the big, big reference books. And it's even, you know, arriving in Greek language now. And I make the same wish for the Hebrew language. You know, may the Dharma flourish in all languages. So we have a tradition of words, and we have a tradition which started with the Buddha of going beyond the words. That the true Dharma is not the word. Remember that simile of the Buddha with the raft, where he compares the Dharma, the words of the Dharma, with a raft which takes us across the stream of suffering, across samsara. And he asked his students, when you reach the other shore and the raft has done its purpose, will you carry it on your back with you? Will you continue? No, you leave. It's too heavy. You leave it there. And he said, that's the same with the words of the Dharma. They will carry you across, but when you reach the other shore, the paramita has been accomplished, you have gone to the other shore, then you become the Dharma. You are the Dharma. And the Dharma will speak from within. And then don't rely on words, but rely on the Dharma within. We call that the Dharma of realization. And Mahamudra is very much such an approach where, yes, one relies on the words, but knows that the true Dharma is beyond the words. And I will not be able to convey the Dharma to you just with the words. They will be more like pointers to the moon, another famous example. We say in the Mahamudra tradition, to teach is like the old lady pointing at the moon. You know, why an old lady pointing to the moon? I don't want to offend anybody in the audience. I'm getting old myself, and my pointing to the moon could very much look like the lady. Look, the moon is there. But look how my finger is. My finger is crooked. The finger is not even pointing to the moon. You know, it's the old lady. She knows the moon is there. Look, the moon is there. And her finger points back to the earth, right? It's like The words are clumsy means to indicate what is really meant. Words are clumsy. Even if they are poetic, even if they are well chosen, they are not the reality we are talking about. And I want to make this clear right from the beginning, that we are from a Buddhist tradition where we use the words in the best possible way with very clear definitions, but it's not the definitions which give the awakening. It's what we call vipassana, the intuitive insight, the clear seeing which comes from within. It is that. It is this non-conceptual understanding. So we will see what we can do in these days. And that was my little introduction. Let's meditate now. Yes, let's see what we can do. View, meditation, action. I've given you a little bit of the view. I've pointed out that action is where we are going. That means we are going to implement it in everyday life. And meditation means to become accustomed, to become familiar. And what we become familiar with is the nature of mind. It is just how it is. And how is it? Let's have another look. Okay? I will guide a little bit. There will be periods of silence. I invite you to make yourself comfortable. I'm very happy to see that some of you have already taken the support of the wall. Please do that. Lean against the wall if you feel like it. The others who have energy, you're very welcome to sit straight. But if you feel like wanting to rest and to give it up to the wall, you know, let the wall carry you, please feel free to do that. Oh, this is so good that you take that inspiration and you do it. Very good. I hope others follow your example if you need. Yes. Starting from the Buddha, when we look at the meditation instructions, for example, in the Anapanasati Sutta or the Satipatthana, we go for meditation in a place where we can withdraw from activity, a so-called secluded place. And although we are many here, when we settle for meditation, it means that for that time, for this period of training, we do not have to deal with all of what we were dealing before. So even if some of you have just been working in the kitchen, that's over now. All of what has been before is over. And we arrive in this ungraspable now, this flowing experience. And in the Mahamudra tradition, we start by opening all senses. So please, especially if you are drowsy, open your eyes. If you're drowsy, open your eyes very wide so that you can see the light from above. If you're not drowsy, you're okay to meditate with closed eyes. Open the visual sense, and maybe if you're not so used to it, use a little point in front of you, an area where your eyes can rest without examining what you see, just resting somewhere. And those who feel at ease, you can also lift the gaze a little bit more, just as you are comfortable. And the idea is to take in all the light which there is, to receive the light, not to close it out, to open up to the colors, just as you would do an activity. We are preparing for activity. Those of you who might feel uncomfortable with opening the eyes, just open them from time to time and then close them again. Just try from time to time. No straining on the eyes, just relax them as you would when looking into a beautiful meadow with lots of flowers. You look into the distance, into a valley with a lot of sky. Relax your eyes. And the basic attitude is one of not clinging to anything. So we also don't have the idea that the eyes have to remain absolutely still. By nature, they are built in such a way that they oscillate a little bit. This gives them relaxation. And do the same thing with the hearing. Open to all the hearing experiences. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling the body, feeling all the physical sensations. So these are the so-called five outer senses, the body-based senses. Allow your attention to move in this field of five senses. Not holding on to anything, just in the flow of a very alive experience. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and an overall experience of our physical presence. And please also include now the sixth sense, the awareness of what's going on in terms of thinking, feeling, how it is to be in the group. All of what is going on. We are not going anywhere special, just being fully present here with all senses open. I have heard that all of you have already done Vipassana retreats. So what we are practicing now is an open awareness with no clear support. The support for meditation is actually the flowing experience of all six senses. And I guess you're familiar with looking into anicca, the impermanence, the actually here that is the changing nature, the ungraspable nature of this ever-changing now. So let us be aware of just this quality of the present experience being so clear yet not definable. This would be the anatta, the non-self of phenomena, of all these experiences. This very nature of just now. And take a rest. How about the ventilator? Is that needed? Shall we try without? Okay. I was walking meditation. Maybe a little word of how Lila and I plan to work together. Whenever I don't know how to continue, I pass the microphone over to her. Basically, she teaches me about how to teach in Israel. And the idea is that at times, I would look over to you and say, and you, what would you say to this? And how does this feel to a person mainly trained in the Vipassana and so on, and then we can maybe establish a little bridge of understanding. Lila asked me to be the main teacher because I'm supposed to introduce something here, to explain something, this Mahamudra tradition. But now for the walking meditation, I will say something a little bit later. You say a few words to that, and you use my microphone.
Just a reminder, and maybe we can sort of combine what we heard now with what we know about walking. But maybe I would stay with a pointer of just relaxing into each and every step. So also founding the foundation, connecting to the earth, remembering we are walking under the pale light of the stars, which is such a gift to do, even right on the first day. And keep reminding ourselves we can relax, rest and relax, even during walking. This is the doing, this is the action. And the view is one of love and friendship. So step by step with that, we let it grow in us in a very easy and relaxed way. So please enjoy walking. We will see you here at 9 o'clock for the final meditation of the day.